So it's not your imagination. Teenagers really do have a lot in common with wild animals. Between childhood and adulthood, there is this fraught period of development across species when adolescent humans and animals flirt with danger, seek social status, negotiate the difficult terrain of dating, and find out how to live on their own. Dr. Barbara Nadison Horowitz is a visiting professor at Harvard and co-author of a book that looks to nature to explain the sometimes inexplicable choices that teenagers make. And her book is called Wildhood, The Epic Journey from Adolescence to Adulthood in Humans and Other Animals. And Dr. Barbara Nadison Horowitz joins us now. Hello there.
Hi there.
Was there a light bulb moment, Barbara, where you thought, hey, that wild animal is just like my teenager?
Actually, there was. So Catherine Bowers and I have been working together for a decade, and we turn to the natural world to identify animal species that may contain either in their bodies, their physiologies, or in their behavior, some insight for human health. And in the first 5 years of our collaboration, we were working on a book about cancer and heart disease and psychiatric issues in humans. So we were up looking in Northern California along the coast, and we were looking at a group of California sea otters who were frolicking in this little bay there. And as we were looking at the otter, the wildlife biologist we were with pointed to the ocean, and we looked over to the sea, and he said, what you're looking at is called the Triangle of Death. It's this incredibly dangerous zone for these sea otters because it's packed with great white sharks. And he went on to say that the adult sea otter never go into the Triangle of Death. And of course, the juveniles who are with their moms don't. But he said there's one group of California sea otter that regularly go in, and it was the adolescents. And both Catherine and I, my kids are a little bit older than hers, but we had kids who were entering adolescence. And that really was a light bulb moment that got us hooked.
How could you be sure, Barbara, that what you were seeing was actually something worthy of study, that it wasn't you anthropomorphizing, attributing human characteristics to animals?
Right. So the very first question we had was, is there even adolescence in animals? I had actually studied anthropology, and I had somewhere along the line learned that adolescence was uniquely human. And I think Catherine had heard that or read that our modern human times actually had created human adolescence or the challenges associated with it. In other words, it seemed that there was something, an idea that it was uniquely human. So one of the things that we've been doing in our collaboration over many years is sort of pushing back on assumptions about human uniqueness. We did that in our first book, Zubiquity, but we decided we would do the same thing. And so we started asking the question, well, what is adolescence? And we decided to define it in our own way. We said, well, if the beginning of puberty is its onset, so that's a biological moment, then and its conclusion is when a mature adult emerges, does that exist across non-human animal species? And we know, and we're quickly knew, a lot about animal puberty. We studied puberty in crustaceans and fish and reptiles and all kinds of things. We even wrote a chapter on dinosaur puberty. We called it Jurassic puberty. And we realized that, you know, as an animal moves through life, its body changes, but so does its level of experience. And my 13-year-old son, I remember when he was 13, he was 6 feet tall. So he had a big body, but he was low in experience. And that's precisely what we see in birds who are about to fledge. That is, their bodies are big enough for them to leave direct parental protection, but they lack experience. And the same thing is true for for mammals and even some fish. And so we ended up coming up with this term wildhood, which is essentially the period of life between puberty and the moment an adult emerges And we found lots and lots of similarities. So we were satisfied that, yes, indeed, non-human animals do experience adolescence.
Yeah, you write that the four fundamental challenges of wildhood, as you call it, are the same for a fruit fly coming of age in the bananas on a kitchen counter, a lion roaring into adulthood on the Serengeti, and a 19-year-old who's balancing work, school, friends, and relationships. So what are those four challenges?
Yeah, a lot of them were pretty surprising and very exciting to us. So the first is just staying safe. And one of the commonalities between animal adolescents and human adolescents is that they may be big in body, but they are low in experience. They're often targeted by predators because they're easy prey. You know, they fall for everything. And in our species, very often they're exploited because of that same naivete. And there's lots of different groups that exploit adolescents because they... You know, they're not wily yet. And so that's one core competency. The second thing that adolescents need to learn to do is find a place in groups. And there's lots of consequences of not learning how to do this. You know, young fish have to learn how to school. Birds need to learn the courtship songs and other kinds of, you know, forms of communication. And if they don't learn how to do that with others, then it can be catastrophic for them. One of the most important things that happens in adolescence also is that animals begin to understand the rules of their groups. And it turns out the human mood variation that a lot of our teenagers have, you know, that kind of the crazy moods or mood swings, those are created by brain systems, this very similar brain systems to the brain systems that help animals understand their status in groups. So the same brain systems that are at work in, let's say, a crustacean, a lobster, or a fish when he loses status or when he gains status are involved in the formation of human mood. And that was really a fascinating connection for us to make, and I'm summarizing several years of research. But it was particularly notable for me because I had a daughter who was just getting involved with social media. This was several years ago, and I wasn't familiar with social media, but I was noticing how affected she was by it and how, you know, things seem almost life or death, that status and profile online had so much salience for her and her friends. And so one of the things that this led us to consider is this biology of comparison that evolved in non-human animals and which is alive and well in our human brains and is particularly sensitized and triggering in adolescence.
Yeah, luckily there's no lobstergram, so the lobster can deal with it on a day-to-day basis, but doesn't need to deal with it online as well. You can really start to understand how that's become concentrated in something like social media. And I wonder if that's part of your goal here, that you want parents to start thinking about some of the rough patches of being a teenager as part of nature, you know, to look at it, yes, through a sort of an evolutionary perspective rather than some of the stuff that generally get blamed, hormones and brain development.
Oh, 100%. I mean, one of the most exciting things about looking at human behavior through an evolutionary lens and a comparative lens, and by comparative, I mean, you know, we're talking comparing different animal species, is that it gives an explanation that moves beyond the traditional, well, first of all, parent blaming, which is, you know, I'm not saying that our parents aren't and we as parents aren't responsible for some of the stuff that happens with our kids. But one of the things that my research has done is to really blow open many of the assumptions about the parental causes of, for example, adolescent depression and eating disorders and self-injury and all these kinds of things. Yeah, I was a physician for many years. I'm a professor of medicine, and I was actually trained in cardiology, but also in psychiatry. And in all of my training, I never considered, nor was I taught, to think about the animal origins of human behavior. I mean, somewhat around primate behavior, but really to look broadly. So yeah, I mean, one of the things, for example, around social media is that you know, it's really painful for kids to be excluded, and it's really painful to be humiliated in real life or online. And once, you know, and when my own kids were teenagers and they'd be upset about, you know, some kids saying something obnoxious to them or maybe not getting invited to a party, my reflexic response would be, you know, what do you care? I mean, who are they? What? But now that I really understand how important that for non-human animals, status is literally a matter of life or death, right? So high-ranking fish get more food, occupy safer positions in the school. You know, even high-ranking crayfish occupy, you know, more thermally optimal, you know, water. I mean, there's just all of these benefits to status in group living animals. And so animals who achieve higher status are rewarded with these serotonin little bursts. And the opposite happens when they fall in status. And so status is essentially, I mean, it leads to a change in brain chemistry, which in our species is very painful, especially if there's rapid status descent. I wish I had known that. I wish I'd understood that. And even some of the stuff related, frankly, just to eating. I mean, now that, you know, part of our study was to look at how some fish who are adolescents, who are subordinates, decrease how much they eat so that they don't get big enough to be challenging to the dominants who then try to attack them. So this idea of self-regulating food to create an optimal body size, or the opposite end of things, how some adolescent subordinate birds are forced to overeat because they don't know when they're going to get their next meal. So there are many connections that never occurred to me as a physician, never occurred to me as a mother of teenagers. But now that I regularly apply the methodology that we've developed we look from fish, amphibians, reptiles, birds, and non-human mammals at this phase of life, it's transformed how I think about like how things are caused in the first place.
I'm talking to Dr. Barbara Nadison-Horowitz. She's a visiting professor at Harvard, and her book is called Wildhood, The Epic Journey from Adolescence to Adulthood in Humans and Other Animals. And she tells the stories of four wild animals tracked by biologists over time. Not sure if we get to all four of them, but I definitely want to talk about Ursula, the king penguin in Antarctica. What can we learn from Ursula?
Yeah, well, we decided that we would feature the four core competencies by telling the stories of actual wild animal adolescents. And the way we found these individuals was to look at wildlife biology studies that had involved radio tracking, GPS or satellite tracking groups of animals, and then to identify individuals who had been tracked very closely and had multiple data points, and to tell their stories. So for safety, which was the first of the four core competencies, we chose Ursula, who was an adolescent king penguin, who along with her peers, that is her cohort, the group that were hatched in the same year, walked to the edge of the water on, you know, South Georgia Island, and walked right in and began the fledge, that first departure where they're on their own with no parental protection, no parental feeding. And we tell her story literally by using the data points provided by the penguinologists who were studying that group of king penguins. And what we learned from Ursula's life, by the way, they named each of the penguins they were studying. So Ursula was not our name, it was theirs, but we love it. What we learned from Ursula is that for every 10 king penguin, again, depends upon the year, but for every 10 king penguin that walk into the water, as few as 5 will return. So it's very dangerous in the beginning. Those penguins are big in size, but they're low in experience. They get lost. They don't know how to hunt. And the leopard seals and the orca who are waiting for them literally are able to nab the most naive. But what was fascinating about it is that the scientists tracked these king penguins and their survival year after year after year. And it turned out, although it was incredibly dangerous the first year, if they survived the first year and gained experience, by the second year, they were safer. And by the third year, even safer, and so on and so forth. So inexperience may be deadly, but experience is what is the basis of safety. The challenge is gaining the benefits of experience it without having a catastrophe. So it's sort of having the brush with death minus the death. And that was, it made sense as we were looking at it, but the statistics were really startling. We saw how beneficial experience is for safety for adolescents. And since both of us had kids who were learning how to drive, and both of us knew that our kids were required to go through a series of safety steps before they could get a full license with no restrictions, we were really kind of awed by the wisdom of that and thought that this is something that could be generalized to other aspects of adolescent life.
We've talked a wee bit about status. What about this sexual development? That's obviously a bit more nuanced and complicated than we might think in animals. What did you find?
Yeah, there were several really interesting takeaways. I mean, we teach a class at Harvard called Coming of Age on Planet Earth. And by the way, our students are themselves adolescents. They're 18 to 22 years old. And, we talk about issues that are a great concern in their lives. And of course, one of them are the challenges of connecting romantically and finding partners and having meaningful experiences. And so there have been a couple of really important developments that have emerged from our research and also from just teaching this class. One from our research has to do with when animals have their first time. That is when they first have sex, essentially. So before doing this research, I had assumed that in the wild, animals go through puberty and then they start mating and having offspring. And what I didn't know was that, while that certainly happens at times, in many groups of wild animals, bodies hit puberty and become reproductively capable. That is, their bodies can make offspring, but for a variety of reasons, they don't start having sex. I mean, they are either reproductively suppressed by older, more dominant members who are keeping all the mating opportunities for themselves. In some instances, they can't start to mate until they've mastered courtship. And, you've seen these courtship rituals, right, in every David Attenborough documentary, and these beautiful rituals. You see birds, you see insects, you see just so many courtship rituals. But we began looking at this and realized that, so one of the most important aspects of being an animal adolescent is mastering courtship rituals. That just because you have a body that can have offspring doesn't mean you're really ready to be a competent parent, which is part of it. And this is, I'm really simplifying a much more complex topic, but that was really fascinating to us and led us to a secondary finding and a secondary a whole study that we performed, which is the question of sexual consent in the wild. On college campuses, at least in the United States, and I teach at Harvard, but also at UCLA in California, conversations about sexual consent and coercion are really important. And students and faculty are struggling to improve how we understand and how we communicate with each other. And I think Me Too has fueled it, but it's a very important conversation. Catherine and I became really interested in exploring the concept of sexual consent in wild animals. In other words, in the wild, what happens when she says no or he says no? And there's been a history of turning to the animal world to understand sexual coercion. And some of those efforts have not been done particularly well. Some of them have had some pretty
dodgy.
I think dodgy, and yeah. I'll even take it a step farther and say misogynistic assumptions. But what we really wanted to do was to, in a really systematic, scientifically credible, reproducible way, not explore sexual coercion, but to invert it and to explore sexual consent. And so what we found was essentially that, consent exists, or rather courtship exists, among reproductively active animals. And courtship is a two-way conversation, typically with many, many steps. in which both individuals are back and forth saying, should we or shouldn't we? Yes or no? Is it going to happen or not going to happen? And we tell the story of Drosophila, of fruit flies, that even fruit flies, both the male and the female, go through this back forth with multiple steps. And in their fruit fly brains, they both have yes, no, go, stop. So we loved this. And we thought, you know, instead of trying to see, to look for the evolutionary origin of sexual coercion, let's invert it and point out how the capacity for consent, the building blocks, the evolutionary origin of human consent can be found among wild animals.
We're out of time. I do just want to mention, though, that you have discovered by studying eagles that sometimes it's necessary to be a bit of a mean parent.
Yeah, the article caught both of our eyes. It's called parental meanness. That's actually the term that it's used. These Spanish imperial eagles, if they have young who have gotten old enough to fledge, that is to leave the nest, and they just won't leave, they put their talons together like a club, and they fly fast behind their basically eagle teenagers, and they thunk them the back of the head to get them to get out of the nest. They call it parental meanness. And we thought that was pretty funny and could sort of relate. I won't say more than that. But
yeah, anyone who has tried to kick out a millennial from the family home will be reassured to hear that the eagles who get kicked out do better than the ones who don't, right?
Yeah. Well, we looked at overprotection among in adolescent fish versus underprotection. And yeah, I mean, there's no question that overprotection deprives animals of getting the skills that they need. But the flip side, and this actually really surprised me even more, was that in the animal kingdom, sometimes even young adults who've left the nest, for example, certain penguins who've fledged, may come back to get some extra feeding, extended parental care.
Yeah. Great. Well, hopefully you won't have to physically attack your own children to get them out of the house. There's so much in the book, and we've barely scratched the surface, but congratulations on it. It's called Wildhood, The Epic Journey from Adolescence to Adulthood in Humans and Other Animals, and Dr. Barbara Nadison-Horowitz. It's been great to chat to you, and well done.
Thank you so much.